acorns are dropping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, fiery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 102, Venochni Tsukrovi. Sunday, December 20th, 2015. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me as Sarah Pomegranate on social media. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. You can find photographs and links to the things I talk about on the show notes, which are located at yarnsatyinhu.com. Welcome and hello. Thank you to everyone who has been in touch since the last episode, episode 101. In that episode, I talked about a little pattern for a votive cover for a mason jar, and the pattern design is by Jen Sheelan. And not long after the episode aired, I heard from Jen, and we came up with this idea to have a little impromptu Instagram contest for a listener or an Instagram follower and a friend to win copies of that pattern. So that prize has been awarded. Congratulations to Summery Day and her friend Knitting Geisha. I also wanted to mention that Jen Sheelan has a few other patterns to make your holiday brighter. There's a pattern called Victorian Yuletide that is a beautiful design for some glass ornaments. And there's a pattern very similar to the Fairy's Firelight called Glow Flake, which is for another votive cover for a mason jar with a beautiful snowflake pattern on it. So I hope you get the opportunity to check out Jen Sheelan's patterns and make your holiday a little bit brighter. After 100 episodes, I thought it might be a good idea to reintroduce myself a little bit. And in the last episode, I talked about my home, Yin Hu, and a little bit about the reasoning for the title of this podcast. And today I thought I'd share a bit about my history as a crafter. It's a really short one because I grew up in a family of dedicated craftspeople. My mother is an excellent seamstress. She also does basket weaving and just a host of other traditional kinds of crafts. My father was a gunsmith, a cabinet maker. He did leather working. He participated in period reenactments. So he made a lot of the things associated with his costume and the tools that he used. And both of my younger sisters are also amazing crafters. Jessica does beadwork. She's now into quilting. And my sister Laura, she's probably the craftiest of them all, and her interests are so diverse, it's hard to characterize them. But I think what distinguishes her is she can do amazing things with paper. She does a lot of really interesting paper crafting. But I was the bookish one. I was never interested so much in a craft. I never had anything that really identified me as a crafter. I could do a lot of things, and I would help, or I would, you know, dabble in something, but it was never really me. I took a class called Crochet for Stress Relief at the school where I work. I took it unwillingly. A colleague of mine put a lot of pressure on me to go, and I didn't think I would like it. Actually, I knew I would not like it. And after the first session, I didn't even have to pretend that I liked it, which is something else I was worried about, because I didn't want to offend any of my other colleagues or the administrator who was facilitating the class. But I didn't even have to fake it, because I just right away, I felt like, wow, this is so interesting. And I just loved the satisfaction of having the yarn in my hands. And it turned out that shortly following the first or second session of that class, we had a terrible snowstorm and ended up with, I think we ended up with a 4-day weekend. And I crocheted every bit of yarn that I had. And then I wanted to keep going, so I unraveled it and made something else. I was looking up patterns online. I was watching YouTube tutorials. I just wanted to keep doing it. That was about 6 years ago. And then I realized that, you know, knitting had some additional possibilities. And one of the reasons I wanted to try knitting was that I was crocheting a lot of gifts and everything turned out pretty feminine looking. I found it very difficult to crochet something that didn't look like it was for a woman or for a baby. I found one sort of waffle scarf crochet pattern that I knit for my sister's boyfriend. But other than that, I was really frustrated by the pattern choices and the look of things made in crochet. So I thought I would try knitting, and I was really fascinated by Stacy of Very Pink and her video tutorial for an entrelac scarf made of Noro yarn, which I thought was like the most amazing thing ever. And I didn't realize that entrelac was sort of difficult for a beginning knitter, and I really wanted the scarf. I guess from that you can tell that I'm much more of a product-oriented crafter than a process. So I bought the yarn and I made the scarf. It's not without its mistakes, but it's a good scarf. I still wear it. I still love the yarn. And that just started me on this interest in knitting as well. I had always been a podcast listener, and one day I just wondered to myself if there were any podcasts about knitting. Are there any podcasts about knitting? And that's when I discovered video and audio podcasts. And it was really through watching those, especially the video podcasts, that I started to develop an interest in spinning and also weaving, which I hadn't thought about very much before. And so I took a spinning class at a relatively local yarn shop. And Betty, my teacher, taught me how to spin using a drop spindle. I had had some prior experience because we have relatives who have raised sheep and also, you know, fancy breeds, alpacas, things like that, in upstate New York. So as a child, I had visited those relatives and I did have an awareness of spinning and weaving and all of that, but I hadn't really done very much of it. So suddenly I had this fascination and I learned to spin and I bought a Louette spinning wheel. And then my mother discovered some things in her attic. So I became the owner of a rigid heddle loom. I also have an inkle loom that I have not used at all. That should probably be on my list of things to do. And I started to learn those skills. About a year and a half ago, I started thinking about a handmade wardrobe and the notion of having less, having a lot less, but feeling really good about having made my own clothing, or at least a good portion of it, and knowing where the fabric came from and knowing what went into the production of those pieces. So last year at Christmas, I received a sewing machine as a gift, and very slowly I have also started working on skills of sewing and dressmaking. And there's a little bit of embroidery in there too. I am so pleased to share all of this with listeners. My success stories as well as challenges I face. And I think more and more my interest is really on creating pieces for a handmade wardrobe, thinking more about what I will really use and wear, not just what's an interesting pattern to make. I still do a great deal of crafting for gifts, and that is unlikely to change because I happen to have just an amazing number of friends and family who are worthy of those kinds of gifts and who really appreciate them when they receive them. But I think more and more I will start to focus my attention on pieces that I will wear, things that work together, and pieces that will work with my very favorite items already in my wardrobe. So I don't intend to, you know, just clean out my closet and get rid of everything that I haven't sewn. I don't have a lot of time to devote to that. So, you know, I will still be wearing things that are ready made. But just thinking more carefully about not really the fashion aspects, but the sourcing aspects. Where did these things come from? What materials are they made out of? And how I can continue to build what I refer to as a mostly handmade wardrobe. In episode 103, I will conclude this little reintroduction series by talking a little bit about how I decided to host a podcast, and maybe most especially the influence that I've felt from other podcasters. The back porch. In the last episode, I talked about completing Suffragette, a pattern for a darling cloche with short rows and welts, and that is designed by Olga Beraya Kafelian. I had completed the knitting on the hat and it was blocking, but I was afraid that it was a bit too large. And upon trying the hat on, I realized that the crown of the hat was really too deep. When I put it on, it wanted to fall over my eyes toward the bridge of my nose. So I decided to unpick the closing and then rip out all of the crown shaping. Because I used 100% wool yarn, and because this hat had been blocked, the stitches just stood there ready to be picked up. It was really great. And the yarn I'm using is I believe it's a Romney Merino blend. It's from Battenkill Fiber Mill in Washington County, New York, and it's been dyed this beautiful tonal copper color. So I picked up all of the stitches and I re-knit the crown, changing the directions for the pattern slightly. The pattern calls for knitting 2 rounds of knit stitches after each set of decreases. And when I re-knit the hat, I just knit 1 round between each decrease round. This shortened the crown of the hat up just enough so that when I tried it on again, it really fit perfectly. I think the band of the hat is not snug, but I think that is in keeping with a typical cloche style, that it should just sit around your hair. It shouldn't mash your hair. And I guess because of my row gauge was just a little bit longer than called for in the pattern, I needed to, you know, take some liberties with the crown decreases. I did not block this again. I just gave the hat a gentle steam from the inside just to firm up the stitches a little bit on the crown. And it's really sweet. It's a darling hat. If you are knitting for someone with a bob or a face framing haircut, I think this would look really good. And it's featured in Pom Pom Quarterly. Once again, that's Suffragette, a pattern designed by Olga Baraya Kefelian. You're probably hoping that I will have Miranda, the sweater by Jose Paquin, on the back porch, but I do not. I am still knitting it slowly. It is going well, but I can't be speedy with this pattern no matter what I do. I don't know why. I guess because I'm knitting a sweater for someone who it's not available for me to try it on. It's making me a little bit skittish and I'm just going slowly. So I'm working on the first sleeve because I took a tip from Twin Set Designs, Jan and Ellen, and I have knit the second sleeve first. So now I'm knitting the first sleeve and I'm putting a very long cuff on the sleeve because I think it would be useful to be able to pull down the cuffs and have them cover your hands and be able to pull your hands up into the sleeves. I haven't consulted my sister, but I think that would be a good idea for a farm sweater. And then when the cuffs are folded up, the sleeve should be the appropriate length. And I still need to put the hood on this sweater and block it. So that should all happen before I see Jessie for the holidays. And I look forward to being able to tell you that Miranda is on the back porch and also being able to show a nice photo of my sister wearing a sweater that fits. We'll see what happens. I have cast on a new project, just something I can take on the go. And a while back, I mentioned that I wanted to create a set of a hat, cowl, and mitts, and that I plan to use the same pattern motif or design for each of those. So I started out by knitting the Bushwalk Beanie, a very nice beanie pattern by Amy Vandelaar. And then I intend to replicate the Fern Fronds pattern motif onto a cowl and then onto some mittens. So I began the cowl. I'm knitting it in a heavier weight yarn, like a DK. It's between a DK and a worsted weight. This is a variegated yarn. I began the cowl with a tubular cast on. I knit about an inch of 1x1 ribbing. And then I began the Fern Fronds design by Amy Vandelaar. That is going well. It's a 4-row repeat once the Fern Fronds pattern is established. And it's a really rhythmic, therapeutic sort of design, just going around and around and watching these beautiful fern fronds emerge. So the next step of this hat, cowl, and mitts trio will be the mitts, and I will be searching for a mitten pattern, a very plain mitten pattern in a fingering weight, and then trying to see how I can replicate this fern fronds design on the back of the mitt. So if you have a pattern suggestion for a very plain sort of mitten, maybe with a long cuff, I don't like the kind of mittens that just start at the base of your hand. I would really like to have something with a long cuff so that I can wear it with shorter sleeves, or, you know, it won't escape from the cuff of my jacket. I think that would be good. And then I will be figuring out a way to put that design on the back of the mitten. I think this is an interesting challenge for me because I haven't thought a lot about how to follow a pattern but make substantial changes to the pattern. And this assists my design mind in reverse engineering and thinking about stitch count and, you know, how one design can be transferred to something else. So it's an interesting exercise for me and taking me a little bit further into the process knitting rather than just focusing on the product of the knitting. You know, find the pattern you want and then get the yarn and start knitting. So this is developing my process mind and my design mind a little bit more, which is something I'd like to focus on in the coming year. Chinwagon. This past Wednesday was our holiday club meeting of String Theory, the Knit and Crochet Club. We had our photograph taken for the yearbook. There was great attendance. I think there were 9 or 10 knitters and crocheters, crafters there. We had holiday music. We had snacks and cookies. Everyone was working on a project. There was a little impromptu Pollyanna gift exchange, and just all around, it was such a good time. It's just such an extraordinary thing what happens when these students enter my office, dump off these amazingly heavy backpacks that they've been carrying around all day, and you can hear the stress just rolling off of them, and they just pull out their projects and start chatting. And these students are from all different grade levels. They are folks who are not already friends, not traveling in the same social circles necessarily, or participating in the same activities, or taking classes at the same academic level. They are very, very different. And yet, when we take out our crafting and just start chatting, just this beautiful, wonderful thing happens. So we were all, you know, there was sort of a quiet lull in the conversation. And then one of the students said, "Oh, we have something for you." And unbeknownst to me, some of them had been working on a collaborative gift. They had knit or crocheted squares out of this beautiful purple yarn. And then one of our knitters, who is extremely accomplished, took all of these. They were sort of different sizes. Some were knit, some were crochet. And she managed to graft all of them together into a cowl for me. It's so beautiful. It doubles around my neck, so I was wearing it the next day. And it was just such a surprise and such a really beautiful, nice gift. So I'm very grateful, and I'm looking so much forward to picking up this club again. We take a bit of a hiatus in the deep midwinter because I need to develop a few other aspects of my program, and that takes some after-school time. So I don't typically run String Theory Club meetings in January or the beginning of February. I think these students will continue to meet in the library and continue to work on their crafting. I think they have such a developed skill set now that they can definitely help one another. And then we will pick up our meetings sometime around Valentine's Day. Ever-expanding skill set. Expanding my skill set this past week has focused on holiday cookie baking, and I have tried two new recipes, and I've revived something I've done in the past. Last week, I talked about making gingerbread, but I decided to alter that direction a little bit and go for pfeffernusse. My grandmother made these, and I remember a very small, very highly spiced cookie that was covered in powdered sugar. Pfeffernusse translates pepper nuts, and I found a recipe that has a lot of clove, cardamom, and also freshly ground black pepper. So they are very highly spiced. There's also molasses in the batter. And instead of covering them with powdered sugar, as I remember my grandmother doing, I decided to dip these in chocolate and then use a white chocolate drizzle to decorate them. And they are very, very good. Then I started to think about other holiday cookies with sort of an international flair, and I found a recipe for brigadeiro. These are a Brazilian confection, really more of a candy than a cookie, but they are quick to make, and they were very impressive at my office holiday party. So I have linked to the recipes I've used for both pfeffernusse and brigadeiro in the show notes. Then I decided that I would tackle the venoční cukroví. These are Czech Christmas cookies, and the term that is the title of this podcast is the collective term for Christmas cookies. There's a Czech tradition of starting on December 6th, making a very wide variety of Christmas cookies. For many years, my college roommate and I would get together during the beginning of December, not necessarily December 6th, but at the beginning of December. And we were making about 12 to 16 varieties of Christmas cookies. We used a lot of tools and molds that Misha's mom had sent over from Czech and her grandmother's Christmas cookie recipes. In fact, her mother was at first astonished that we would go to the trouble of making them. She said, "No one makes these anymore. You just buy them." And Misha said, "Well, you can't buy them in the States. We don't have anything like that. The only way to get these cookies, unless you're maybe if you're in a city center with some sort of Czech population, there might be a bakery that has them, but it's very difficult to get anything like that here." And so we started to learn how to make all of these recipes. I think the distinguishing characteristic of these venoční cukroví is their small size and the fact that they are very highly decorated with chocolate and nuts. They look almost like candies rather than cookies on the plate. American Christmas cookies tend to be very large and they're often very literal depictions of things with a cutter and then with colored sugar. These are much more sophisticated looking. And I realized how much I had missed them because it's been several years since we've been able to get together, and it's not something that I've undertaken on my own. I opted to take on the most simple version of venoční cukroví, which is linecké testo. And that's a lince dough. You can make it in vanilla and chocolate. And then we developed over the years a system of making these cookies. At first, we were just cutting them out and filling them and decorating them in like a haphazard fashion. So they all look different. But gradually, we move toward this approach of, if you took a cookie from the plate and you bit into it and you really liked it, if you took another one that looked exactly like that, it would have the same flavor profile. So I cut out two shapes from the vanilla dough and two shapes from the chocolate dough, and then I made four different fillings. I used orange and vanilla for the chocolate cookies, and then I used chocolate and hazelnut for the vanilla cookies. And they were a labor of love, but they turned out quite well. And I took a photograph, which is the cover photograph of a plate of all of these different kinds of cookies. And I think they will make a very special holiday. I have linked to a blog post by a young woman who decided to make Linz dough and fill cookies with jam. And that recipe is very similar to the one I used from Misha's grandmother. One thing that makes the Linz dough a little bit less stressful is that you measure the ingredients by weight, very typically European, rather than by quantity. And I feel that gets a more consistent result. Misha and I used to joke that if you didn't have time to bake these cookies, you could just replicate the calorie count by taking a stick of butter and dipping it in sugar and chocolate and then taking a bite out of it. I made about 150 cookies and I used 3 pounds of butter. So they're not a diet food, but I think they will definitely go a long way to making the holiday special. And baking them and decorating them while I listened to some Christmas music definitely got me into the holiday spirit. Not to mention that it has turned rather cold and frosty here in eastern Pennsylvania, and that is just making it feel like it's really Christmas time. And so forth. I have completed the sewing on the Pearl Shift. It is a dress pattern by Green Bee Patterns. And I had a lot of trouble with my selection of fabric to go with this pattern. I chose a really beautiful flannel plaid, but it was extremely thick. And I had trouble maneuvering it, not really for the seams or for the sides with the pockets, but for the front placket. So the style of the shift that I chose had a button front Henley sort of placket. And doubling this fabric or tripling the fabric and trying to sew through it was really challenging. Trying to match the plaid design on the front and the sides was also challenging. I did a very good job on matching in the front and matching for the sleeves, but the sides are not perfectly matched. What else did I want to say about this? Oh, because of the thickness of the fabric and the nap, I guess, or the texture of the flannel. I had a really difficult time transferring all of the markings of the pattern onto the fabric. And I think this caused me to make some poor decisions when I was cutting in the front. And the only way I could get the whole placket and front to come together was to put a little bit of a pleat right under that button placket, which has no buttons, by the way, because it's way too thick to double it up and put a button there. It would be like cardboard. It's so thick. So I've just left the top open for sort of a split front look to it. And then there's this weird pleat. I also did not use the flannel fabric to do the binding, the bias binding around the neckline or the sleeves, because it would just be way too thick. So I used some alternative fabrics there. I like the flare of the dress. I love the length. I love the pockets. It's a little bit different way of inserting pockets than patterns I've done before, and I really liked that. I feel like the top is a little too small for my shoulders and that the bottom is a little too flared and wide for my size, which is usually the opposite of the way I cut out patterns. I will often cut the top to size and then just cut the bottom a little bit wider because I wouldn't want anything to be too tight in the hips. But I think I will trace this pattern again, and I will choose the sizing a little bit differently. I think I will choose the large size for the shoulders and maybe the small, or something between the medium and the small, for the flare on the bottom. And I will definitely make this pattern again with a more traditional kind of fabric. I think a cotton or maybe a linen blend would be ideal. I love the design of this flannel plaid. It's so cute, but it really wasn't a very good choice for this Henley top. So I think I will wear this. I mean, it's a little bit odd. It's a teensy bit ill-fitting, but it's very warm and very comfortable, and it fits. Just that I think the design elements and my failure to follow through exactly on the pattern are what's lacking in this. So I've pledged to try a pattern 3 times before I move on to something else, and I've been pretty successful in doing that. So I think I will try this pearl dress for a second time with a better fabric choice and then report back on my progress. And this time I really would like to take that step of doing the button placket, because that was part of a new skill set that I wanted to develop. I do plan to host one more episode before the new year. So I hope you enjoy your crafting, your baking, and your holiday celebrations, and you will hear from me again in a week.
Acorns are dropping off my Jenny's house. Two ducks in my spyglass, flowery as a mouse. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves her down like a lady, waiting for a naked man. River bends like an elbow, turning stones to sand. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow fire. Just like Linda Curtis, a bird out on a wire. It's a silly nature thing. It's a silly nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is Sweet. Music and lyrics by Samuel St. Thomas, performed by Krista Long and Cesar Diaz. If you enjoyed today's episode, I hope you will consider liking the show's Facebook page, joining the Yarns at Yinhu group on Ravelry, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature.